I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Today on Smart City, we'll speak with Galen Burrows. She's a staff attorney at the Family Defense Practice at the Bronx Defenders in New York City. She's written an article for the spring issue of Ms. Magazine that describes a disturbing trend in the foster care system. We'll also speak with Eddie Friel. Eddie was the chief executive of the Greater Glasgow Tourism Board. We'll find out how he transformed the reputation of Glasgow, Scotland, from a grimy industrial town into one of Europe's most fashionable cities. All that, plus City View's commentator Walker Smith, the latest news from Planet Edison, and an audio essay from our producer, Scotty Iseri, coming up today on Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Galen Burrows is a staff attorney for the Family Defense Practice at the Bronx Defenders, an organization of more than 100 criminal and civic attorneys dedicated to providing comprehensive public defense services for the poor. In her work at the Bronx Defenders, Galen noticed some startling disparities in the foster care system. She's written an article for Ms. Magazine about how inattention to poverty is causing a racial divide in the foster care system. In your story, Too Poor to Parent, from Ms. Magazine, you write that black children are the most overrepresented demographic in foster care nationwide. Give me the facts.
Well, as of 2004, when these statistics were culled, there were about 34% of the children in foster care were black children, but black children only make up about 15% of all children in the United States. So they are disproportionately represented in foster care nationwide. Regionally, you see even more of a disproportion. For example, in New York City, only 4% of the children in foster care are white, and 96% of children in foster care in New York City are children of color. About 56% are African American.
And why do you think that is?
I think part of the reason has to do with poverty. Blacks are four times as likely to live in poverty than other groups, and poverty is a major reason for children entering into foster care, for inadequate food, clothing, shelter, inadequate housing, lack of health care, and mental health services.
If a parent is indeed too poor to parent, I mean, is the foster care system better? Is it a better option?
I don't believe so. I mean, I think that that question sort of assumes that poor parents have nothing to offer their children. And I think that with proper support and services, that it's almost always better for children to remain with their parents. I think that there is a certain level of trauma that comes with removing children from their homes, especially for older kids and newborns. And I think that the statistics in terms of foster care aren't that great. For example, a lot of my clients actually are still in the foster care system or have aged out of the foster care system, and we see a cycle where their kids are now being taken into the foster care. So I'm not sure that it's better, and I think that we should probably be doing much more to strengthen families, because those types of things will strengthen communities more generally and, you know, lead to greater outcomes.
Let me make sure I understand what you just said, Galen. You said that children who have been in foster care and age out of foster care are now having their own children who are then entering foster care. Is that what you said?
Yes.
All right. Then let's ask a hard, politically incorrect question.
Sure.
Why are these people having children?
You know, I think that the choice to have children is a very complicated one, assuming that some of these parents actually have the choice. So I think that I can't really answer that question. I mean, I think that there needs to be, of course, comprehensive sex education for all teenagers, and actually for children who are younger, age-appropriate sex education. I also think that we need to just confront people or meet them where they are. So I think it's a good question to ask. Maybe we should be doing something more education-wise to help people make more, I guess, informed decisions about what kind of families they want to have and when. But also, when the children are here, it's kind of too late to have that discussion. So we kind of need to just meet the problem as it presents itself.
And certainly that makes sense. And yet, surely we should be investing something in prevention. You're talking about education. How about contraception?
Oh, of course. Absolutely. Contraception needs to be much more widely available to people, especially when you're dealing with the very poor. I think it's easy for us to assume that contraception is widely available to everyone. But if you're making the choice of what to do with your, you know, $10, $5, and it's between food and something else, you know, maybe buying that pack of condoms isn't necessarily high on your list, and maybe you don't have that much negotiating power within your own relationship. We also have to keep that in mind. So I think that making contraception widespread and available and easily available is important.
Let's go back to the act of removal of children from families. I mean, I can't think of a worse thing than to lose your children. How do the problems of poverty manifest themselves, get reported, and then lead to the removal of children from homes?
I think that one major problem is inadequate housing. And we see that a lot, where families are living in housing conditions that are just subpar. And they are posing a danger to the children living in the household. One of my clients, she had raw sewage leaking into her apartment because her landlord refused to make repairs on an apartment upstairs from her. And that's a huge problem. She actually tried to get help, and that's how she came to the attention of child welfare authorities. Another way that people get reported, maybe through public welfare offices, there's a lot of monitoring going on if you're a poor person. If you live in a shelter, for example, there are people there monitoring you all the time. And shelter conditions aren't necessarily the safest conditions for kids all the time. So that comes to the attention of child welfare authorities a lot. There's reporting by public hospitals all the time. Some of my clients are actually afraid to go to the hospital for routine accidents because people don't believe them when they say they were accidents and they get called in, because there's always that little lurking concern. Well, you live in this neighborhood, you live in this housing complex that's not so safe. Did your child really just fall off the top bunk, or is something more going on? People have to make split-second decisions. They call in these reports, but then, you know, it starts the ball rolling, and removal is not that far behind.
And yet we read about terrible situations where children were not removed. And then, of course, who's blamed? The child welfare workers. So how can you be at once sensitive to the plight of poor parents who may be good parents except for their poverty, which gets in the way of parenting, and parents who, in fact, are abusive or diverting money or doing things that, in fact, impact the child's welfare, not directly related to poverty, but perhaps just bad choices?
Well, I think, first of all, we need to focus on training caseworkers a little bit more. I think that the training for a lot of caseworkers who are actually on the ground going to people's homes is substandard. It's, you know, very short. It's very cursory. And we're actually asking these caseworkers to do a lot. They're the ones that go to the house. Who knows what conditions they're going to see when they open that door. They need to be trained to react to emergencies, but also to be able to stand back and really assess the situation, to know when something might turn more serious and when something is just, oh, my landlord didn't fix the plumbing upstairs. And so there's not a lot of training. Also, we need to look at the legal system a little bit and think about whether or not the legal system is being used effectively. I mean, I'm an attorney, I work in Bronx Family Court, and judges have maybe 5, 10, 15 minutes to make decisions about a child's safety or welfare. And really, can you really make the best decision under those constraints? Are you going to take the safest course, which, you know, might be removal of the child, and just kind of see and wait, see what happens? And by doing so, you might actually traumatize children who could have been helped in their homes. So we need to look at larger institutional issues in dealing with those cases. But the fact is that the cases that you're talking about where kids are seriously hurt or in abusive situations, those represent a small percentage of the cases that occur. And so we need to not forget that these other people are there, and you know, there's a lot of them. I think 60% of cases that come to the attention of child welfare authorities involve only allegations of neglect, not abuse. And so we need to be able to shine a light on those people because they're voiceless in this process. Everyone assumes that if there's a neglect case, then a parent must be doing something really, really bad, and that removal might be the safest option. But in fact, it might be the option that actually destabilizes the family even more and is actually contrary to the best interest of a child.
I don't sense any appetite nationally to make a new assault on poverty. So short of that, what's the practical solution here?
In addition to poverty being an issue, we also have to deal just with bias in general. The disparity that we see in treatment between African American families and other families, we see it at every decision point. So we see it in terms of what reports get called in, the outcome of investigations, which children get removed, and how fast children are returned. So we can also address that bias in addition to poverty, but I do think that there has to be some, we have to create some momentum to address child poverty in particular. But there are also other issues. We can't just say that poverty is the only issue, the only reason that we see this disproportionate number of Black children in foster care. There's also extreme distrust of child welfare authorities within certain African American communities that we can also try to work with, maybe create public-private partnerships, create more services that are targeted towards the Black community, and create those services in partnership with those communities. So there are a lot of things that we can do to start chipping away at the problem.
Galen, I appreciate you being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you.
Galen Burrows is a staff attorney at the Family Defense Practice at the Bronx Defenders in New York City. Her recent article, Too Poor to Parent, can be found in the spring issue of Ms. Magazine. Our next guest on Smart City is Eddie Friel. In 1983, he was appointed the chief executive of the Greater Glasgow Tourism Board. He's widely considered to be the person most responsible for the economic revival of Glasgow after the city lost its manufacturing base. So many older industrial cities in the U.S. are in circumstances similar to those of Glasgow when you began working as chief executive of the Greater Tourism Board there. What year was that?
Well, that was 1983.
And describe the city at that time.
Well, at that time, the city was perceived as being a violent, dirty industrial slum. And it had reached, in fact, the nadir of its economic development. We had a really serious problem where, for some 40 years, following the collapse of the traditional industries, the community had lost their self-belief. There was enormous poverty and social deprivation. The quality of housing was very, very poor. And the future looked particularly bleak. McKinsey and Company, who were international consultants, were invited by a newly appointed economic development agency to carry out an economic analysis and to try to determine how can we stop the further decline of the city, how can we arrest that decline, and how can we define a future which is viable in the longer term. And what emerged from that was that really we needed to start looking at the service economy, because as a manufacturing base, our shipbuilding, our heavy engineering had all collapsed and had but totally disappeared. And the skill sets that we had, of course, did not match the needs of the new economy. And the problem was that because of that skills gap, an entire community was being told that they were surplus to requirement. Well, you may be able to do that with buildings, but you can't do it with human beings. And the whole question is, how do you, if you're going to engage in economic regeneration, it must also be engaged in social regeneration. And that means that trying to tackle the issues from the ground up as opposed to arriving in a place with a bag of solutions in search of a problem, is really the nature and the challenge of what we had to do. And we were told that fundamentally we had to do four things. We had to give the city back to its residents as a place of which they could be proud again, so that it would be seen to be a good place to live and to work. We had to attract inward investment. We had to attract offices to relocate. We had to expand retailing, which was going to be a major driver of the service economy in the future. And we had to develop tourism. And those were basically the four fundamental strands to the strategy articulated by the consultants arising from the economic analysis that was carried out.
You became a leader, of course, in the tourism movement there, but there must have been at least some resistance by people thinking we were an economy based on manufacturing, high-paid jobs, unionization. And now you're taking us to a service economy, a tourism economy that doesn't pay nearly as well, is generally not unionized, although certainly it is in some places and in some parts of the industry. How did you make that transition, and how did it all add up in the end?
Well, there's absolutely no question that there was resistance. And there was resistance because people who have been in the manufacturing industry, and particularly if you've been the shipbuilding capital of the world, there's a great sense of pride in the fact that you have built the liners that are sailing the world's oceans, and suddenly you're not making anything. And if you're not making anything of substance, then that is not considered a real job. And also the question of tourism, surely that's a part-time job, and also it's antisocial working hours, and also it pays very, very poorly. Well, that's to judge an entire industry on the point of entry level. And if you judge any industry on the point of entry level, it's not going to look particularly attractive. But the issue about the tourism industry, which is important to recognize in the 21st century economy, is that where we have a lot of our young people, particularly, who have not got the skills or the competencies or the education to enter the creative economy or the knowledge economy, as we sometimes refer to it as, then what are we going to do? Are we going to condemn them to poverty for the rest of their lives? Or are we going to give them a sense that, yes, you can actually achieve something through your life, you can actually engage in an element of the economy? And that is where the point of entry jobs in the tourism industry are vitally important, because they are replacing those manual worker jobs that used to be available in the manufacturing economy. But where you start has nothing whatsoever to do with where you finish. And that's why it's important that young people understand that the scale of the opportunity presented by the industry is absolutely enormous, and no other industry can do that for you. To put that into perspective, when we began in Glasgow, we had fewer than 1,000 hotel rooms. Today, there are 15,500. There were fewer than 1,200 people employed in the industry in 1983. Today, 68,000 people are employed in the industry, and that's almost three times as many as ever was employed in the shipbuilding industry in its heyday. So we cannot just simply dismiss an entire industry like tourism as a part-time, unimportant industry. It has become one of the major drivers in the transition of economies from manufacturing to a service economy.
So how did you build the city as a product worthy of tourist interest?
One of the most interesting things about that challenge was that when I first arrived in Glasgow, I mean, I was basically a fast-talking Irishman who had just fallen off a plane from New York, and I was about to turn Glasgow into a tourism destination. And of course, the Glaswegians have a wonderful language. They have a language all of their own, and they have an awful lot of expressions. But it's probably the only place on earth where a double positive means a negative. And whenever you say, this is going to be a tourism destination, their response was, aye, right, which was very unbelievable. But ultimately, our challenge was, how do you actually give Glaswegians a sense of pride in their place again? Because they had been denied that. That had been taken away from them. So we really had to tell them that, look, we are at a stage where you've reached the absolute pit of decline. We are now going to start climbing out of that black hole, and we're going to give you the reasons why you're going to be proud in your city again. In order to do that, the brand Glasgow, or the image of Glasgow or the perception of Glasgow to an external audience was so bad that we had to choose an event-led strategy. People would come for a major international event. They wouldn't come to the place, but if the event was good enough, they would come to the event. Sort of pity it's in Glasgow, but we'll go anyway because it's a great event. And we pursued that until such times as we had built the infrastructure in the meantime to give us a real positioning in the marketplace that we needed to be in. We were very fortunate in that in 1983, Her Majesty the Queen opened the Burrell Collection, which was an enormous art collection bequeathed to the city by a successful entrepreneur, Sir William Burrell. He was a ship owner. It's a fantastic collection, up there with the Hearst or any other single collection. And within its first year, it became the number one tourism attraction in Scotland with 1.2 million visitors in its first year. So the real issue then was everybody was asking, an art collection in Glasgow? Surely it's in the wrong place. Surely it ought to be in Edinburgh. But they started to come. And when they started coming, our job was to try to articulate what the new Glasgow was going to look like and what was happening. We had received permission from the Secretary of State for Scotland at that time to build a new convention centre in the city. We were beginning to develop tourism, which at that time people were very, very sceptical about. And also I had a very, very difficult problem in that 95% of all tourists to Scotland in 1983 came from the rest of the UK. And we didn't have a proposition or a reason as to why they should come off the main artery into Scotland, into Glasgow. We simply didn't have a proposition. So our challenge is, and all places face this challenge, what is your point of entry into the marketplace where you're trying to create customers? Because now, whether you like it or whether you do not, as a place, you are competing on the same agenda as every other place. So what is it that you've got that somebody else is prepared to buy, and how are you going to take it to market? And my response to that was I went to Iceland. Iceland had a population of 245,000. Unemployment was something that happened elsewhere. They had a very high disposable income. My challenge was to present Glasgow as if it were Las Vegas to an Icelandic audience, and this we did. And within 12 to 14 months, we had more visitors staying longer and spending more than any other supplying marketplace to Scotland or to the UK. And that is still the case today. And it's vitally important that people understand and the places understand that you cannot wait until you're perfect, because you're never, ever going to be perfect. You have to deal with what you have right now, because ultimately tourism is about creating wealth and creating jobs. And if we don't create those jobs, then we're not going to be able to create or build the bridges of opportunity to those sections of our sectors of our community who are denied access to an economic future. And it's important that we understand the connection that tourism provides between the visiting population and the resident population.
I think the notion of an event-led strategy, when you have nothing else, when the infrastructure is not in place, it is so interesting, Eddie. It reminds me of my challenge years ago in downtown Memphis, 30 years ago, when there was just really nothing there. It was really only a few years after Dr. King had been assassinated in downtown Memphis, and there was such a stain on the city and certainly on downtown, and people were moving away as quickly as possible from that part of the city. So there I was, given the job of bringing people back downtown. And you think, well, how do you do that? What do I have to work with? And you look around and you didn't have much to work with. And so we began, too, with an event-led strategy. So I take your point completely. Well, then came along one of the bigger events there is, and that's the European Capital of Culture. And you won that designation for the city. What effect did that designation have on the city?
It was absolutely transforming, because initially I had a telephone call from the head of the Economic Development Agency who asked, Eddie, what would you say if I told you Glasgow could bid to become the cultural capital of Europe? And I said, I don't know what it is, but I'll have it. And he said, well, the bad news is you've got 4 days. I said, what do you mean I have 4 days? He said, well, it has been sitting on the local authority's desk for the past 4 months. And their response is that that is way out of Glasgow's league. Glasgow had arrived at such a low ebb that even the local administration didn't believe in their city anymore. So I got all of the arts organisations together and the tourism industry sectors, and within 4 days we thrashed out the submission and we sent it off. And fundamentally, because there was no clear articulated criteria, we wrote our own. And we said that, first of all, you had to be a cultural city, otherwise it was silly to seek the designation. Secondly, you had to be able to market the concept, because up until now, no one else has ever heard of it. Thirdly, you had to be able to fund whatever proposals you had, because you weren't getting any additional money from any other government sources. And finally, we had to articulate what was different about us. What was it about Glasgow that would make it stand out against every other city that was competing? And we postulated the theory that we were the first city in Europe that was pursuing a cultural tourism strategy based on events in order to reinvent the city. And if we were successful, then other post-industrial cities in Europe and elsewhere might benefit from our experience if we managed to achieve success.
We'll have more with our guest Eddie Friel after this short break. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Collette, and you're listening to Smart City. For the latest news in the world of urban planning and design, we go to Plan Edison's assistant editor, Nate Berg.
Could trends in urbanization have an effect on the presidential election? Maybe, according to a recent op-ed in the Boston Globe. Author Robert David Sullivan looked at demographics and voting data from the last presidential election to show that density seems to play a role in determining how voters in a specific place will vote. He says that during the 2004 presidential election, fast-growing and ex-urban communities overwhelmingly voted Republican, while central city areas and older suburbs tended to vote Democrat. These areas typically have lower rates of growth, which Sullivan suggests may be the determining factor in how communities and regions vote. He says that with suburbs struggling to sustain themselves and urban areas attracting more residents, the 2008 election may go to the Democrats simply because of demographics. And while many Americans are looking towards the urban core, many immigrants to America are looking back towards home. Immigrant populations are increasingly investing in property in their native countries, according to another article in the Boston Globe. In what is being called the reverse American dream, immigrants to the U.S. are buying up property and building houses back in their home countries. Though this trend is not really new, the fact that more of them are doing it is. Lenders and governments in these native countries are making it much easier for immigrants to obtain loans and develop. Obtaining loans has been a major hurdle for immigrants in the past, but now their governments are recognizing that it makes more sense to encourage them to reinvest in their homeland. And with significantly lower housing prices abroad than in the States, it makes more sense for many immigrants, too. And finally, some East Coast cities are turning back the clock in an effort to revive their stagnant downtowns. old movie theaters from the middle of the 20th century are being revived and repurposed in a number of downtowns across Long Island, according to a recent article in Newsday. Officials are taking their aging and often unused historic theaters and turning them into multi-purpose performing arts centers. Towns such as Islip and Riverhead are bringing the theaters back into the fabric of their downtowns by hosting musical performances, comedy acts, and, of course, movies. And with downtowns across the country showing gradual signs of regeneration, local business owners on Long Island are hoping the renewed interest created by these historic theaters will bring even more people downtown. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of Planetizen.com. Let's return to our conversation with our guest, Eddie Friel. In 1983, when he was appointed chief executive of the Greater Glasgow Scotland Tourism Board, the city was in trouble. Glasgow had a reputation as a depressed factory town. Through his work at the Glasgow Tourism Board, Eddie transformed the city's dreary image, and now it stands as one of Europe's most fashionable cities. Eddie is currently serving as the expert-in-residence at the Hospitality and Research Center at Niagara University in New York. Has there been an evolution? Because you said this is a strategy that can be used in post-industrial cities, tourism, cultural tourism in your case. Cultural tourism can be used as a strategy for reviving post-industrial cities. Now, of course, the rage is we can use the concept of creative industries or, you know, creativity to make the transition to a post-industrial age. Is that an evolution of what you began, or is it something fundamentally different?
The answer to that is that cities have been the center of creativity and innovation for time immemorial. Creativity and innovation didn't begin in the 20th or 21st century. If you go to Athens 500 years BC, and if you go to the Roman Empire, and if you develop all the way through to the industrial cities, not just cultural cities, you will establish that creativity and innovation has been the driver of the economies of those cities since time immemorial. Our challenge is to look at what are the future needs and goods and services of future customers, and how do we as places organize ourselves to be able to cater for those needs? And do we have the right infrastructure in place, and do we have the right quality of life to be able to attract those people and that talent who will allow us to continue to sustain our communities? So when we were looking at trying to fulfill the strategy as articulated by the consultants after they had completed the economic analysis, we knew very, very clearly that our fundamental role was to create customers for the city. Who were those customers? What were their needs? And how could we articulate our case to make it easy for those customers to buy the proposition? And in response to that, when we were designated as the cultural capital of Europe, and I appointed Saatchi's as our advertising agency, they carried out some consumer research in our main target market, which was London and the South at that time. The response to the proposition, come to Glasgow in 1990, it's the cultural capital of Europe, everybody laughed. They thought it was a joke. And this is a key message in terms of places. If the perception of your city is negative in the markets that you are trying to attract, no amount of marketing veneer is going to solve that problem. You really have to tackle that perception and change that perception. So as far as we were concerned, our communications challenge then was we front-loaded all of the communications program with the major international artists that you could only get in Glasgow in 1990. You were not going to get them anywhere else. The Bolshoi Opera, the Bolshoi Ballet, Pavarotti, all of that you could only get in Glasgow in 1990. But as we moved through the communications program, then we moved to the fixed assets which secured the designation in the first place.
Ah, so you used, basically, you traded off existing powerful brands to build your own brand, to get people interested, and then you showed them what you had.
Exactly right.
I was in Liverpool a few weeks ago, which of course is this year's capital of culture. What do you think of Liverpool's efforts, and what do you anticipate the impact on the city will be?
I would be less than honest if I claimed to know what all of Liverpool's proposals are. In terms of what the impact is likely to be, and what I do know so far about what they're proposing to do, they put together a bid, which in fact I helped put together, which is not too dissimilar to Glasgow's, which is based on we needed to have a legacy after the year of culture. It wasn't just simply about 1990. What was going to happen in 1991? And Liverpool is in exactly the same position. It's not about 2008. It's about the 1st of January 2009 and beyond. What is the legacy of their year as cultural capital of Europe going to be? And I think the way Liverpool is approaching that in terms of looking at what kind of infrastructure can they get in place, which will be a legacy as a consequence of their year, is a very important part of their strategy. And I think that they will benefit a great deal from that.
Do you see the Olympics as an equivalent event because of television coverage, perhaps more impact? On the other hand, it's certainly a shorter duration than a year. Certainly that would have some, that would be some equivalency. Are there other events in the U.S. now that you're working here that you think could have that same kind of transformative effect on a city?
Yes, of course there are. But with the Olympics, you need an enormous infrastructure to be able to cater for the Olympics for a very short period of time. Whether less than world cities could compete to host the Olympics and whether it would be worth building the infrastructure that is needed and whether that would be sustainable over a longer period of time is a very interesting challenge, and I doubt whether smaller cities could really afford to cater for the Olympics.
So what would be an event that would be right-sized for a community, say, like the one you're working in now, Buffalo, Niagara?
Well, it's not as if there is one right event. In some cases, you actually end up having to create them. But one of the more interesting things in Western New York is that sport and amateur sport is very, very popular and is very, very big in this part of the world. And the infrastructure is already in place. So the way in which the universities and colleges compete in a variety of different sports is a real opportunity for this area because it has the infrastructure and it also has teams that perform very, very well in a variety of different sports. And over the past couple of years, Buffalo, the city of Buffalo, has been particularly successful in being able to attract those types of events which cater for young people engaged in a variety of different sports. And I think that's an important issue as well in terms of engaging the young people and making sure that we are giving them a future and hopefully creating the right kind of economy where they are going to have jobs here rather than giving them the one ticket out of the place, which unfortunately has been happening in a variety of our cities around the United States for too long.
Do you think, though, that that has the same branding power that, say, a capital of culture designation gives a city, or
no, it doesn't.
No,
it doesn't. But again, it's an iterative process. I mean, when we started in Glasgow, we didn't have the infrastructure for major conventions, for instance. But we chose as a strategy that there were two areas that we wanted to concentrate on in terms of tourism, both of which were location specific to cities. One was short breaks based on events, based on culture, based on shopping, and based on sport. And the other was conventions. And that meant that because convention traffic buys the product on the off-season and the other leisure tourism markets buy it main season, we would have the ability to develop year-round tourism without having huge and enormous peaks and valleys. And that was the strategy which we developed at the outset.
Let me ask you a minute about conventions, because I think that seems like a business that, given high gas prices, the so not fun experience of travel by air, everyone's schedule is time pressed. I'm wondering if you see the next iteration of meetings and conventions. Every city's got a convention center now. It seems like the meetings are either getting much bigger or smaller. Where do you think the next innovation is in the business of conventions and meetings?
I think the big factor over the next few years is going to be the cost of air travel because of the cost of oil. The cost of oil is going to impact enormously on our economy because airlines are the connection to all of our cities in terms of moving people, in terms of moving goods, in terms of just-in-time services and all of that. It's going to be very severely impacted by the cost of air travel. I think there is going to be an enormous change in the airline industry over the next 3 to 4 years. I don't believe we're going to have as many airlines as we currently do. I think there will be a need for consolidation, and I think we will have fewer route structures as a consequence, because the fundamental business principle on which the airline industry was based no longer applies, because it was based on cheap oil. It's doubtful if that is ever going to be the case again, in which case there is going to be an enormous change in terms of access transport to all of the destinations. And already places like Las Vegas are having reduced traffic going into Las Vegas, which is one of the big destinations in the United States. Smaller destinations are going to feel the pinch as well. Therefore, the issue in terms of large-scale traffic for convention industry, there is likely to be a dip in that marketplace for at least the next 2 to 3 years, unless some dramatic change takes place in the cost of oil.
Do you think then that means there is an innovation out there that responds to those changes that are created by high gas prices?
Oh, there already is. I mean, destinations are now moving towards teleconferencing, where people don't have the time to travel, and also the aggravation of traveling. I mean, it just simply is not a pleasant experience right now in the United States. So therefore, if you can engage in teleconferencing, where you can speak to your colleagues and articulate whatever it is you need to in such circumstances, that will reduce the need for meeting in conference format.
And what will that mean to the convention business?
It's not going to die, because ultimately people still need that human contact. They still need to meet their colleagues. And because of globalization, you will still have enormous numbers of people who need to continue to meet, irrespective of the disadvantages that currently exist. And one of the main influences that will impact upon that traffic will be the ability of destinations to operate a successful ambassador program for their cities, where they look towards their universities and to their hospitals, which are leading in research and innovation, where they look to them to invite. All of these people are members of international and national associations, and they will be asked by their destinations through an ambassador program to invite particular conferences to come to their city, because there is something interesting in the research field of the discipline in which they are engaged, which everybody else will be interested in. So the convention industry isn't going to die. It is going to have a rough, tough patch, but like everything else, it will adjust.
Well, there's so much more to explore with you. We need to set up another time to talk, but I thank you for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you very much.
Eddie Friel is the expert in residence at the Hospitality and Research Center at Niagara University in New York. He's perhaps best known for his work as the chief executive of the Greater Glasgow Scotland Tourism Board. Our producer, Scotty Iseri, has what some might consider a bad habit. He likes to talk to strangers. That's how he meets the interesting people that you only run into when living in a city. This week on Smart City, he brings us an audio snapshot from his very own neighborhood, where he met a musician with talent to spare and energy to burn.
You meet interesting people in a city. I was walking over to a friend's house last summer, and I heard this. The sound you're hearing is a man practicing his drums. A man in his late 30s, he's wearing cut-off jean shorts, and he's sitting against a fence next to a parking lot. He was sitting on a drummer's throne and pounding drumsticks against a small piece of cardboard covered with carpet.
I'm Tonči Biočina, originally from Croatia. I'm practicing my rudiments over here in Lawrence and Tallman. So in precision is very important with drums, you know, accuracy. So, for example, I was practicing this on 100 beats.
He was very friendly, and he talked at length about drumming, the theory of rhythms, and how what he was doing was very difficult. And it was difficult. Try a little experiment. Take your pencil or your pen or whatever you have handy and hit the table with it. Now, do that same thing 100 times per minute in the exact same spot. That's what he's doing.
So one has to be able to emphasize the first note on the triplet, But basically, this is for development of a enhanced technique.
But he was also playing songs. With drummers, it's generally hard to tell what song they're playing until they start singing along. So, can you guess what song this is?
People usually like this one. 86, actually. For example, people usually like this one. It's a, you have to sort of to hit snare and a hi-hat at the same time. So it has to be accentuated also.
See what I mean? Would you recognize that? Here's what he's actually playing. Not bad, huh? Now, from Led Zeppelin, he moved straight into this. Does this sound familiar? Probably not. There's this thing about some musicians where if there's a song with some really interesting musicality in it, it doesn't matter how bad the song is. I've seen this a lot with guitar players. They'll learn some really lousy song if it's got a good lick in it. I mean, sure, taste is relative, but I'm not going to listen to hours and hours of Yngwie Malmsteen just so I can figure out how to go middly, 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 middly like he does. But you got to admire Tonji's dedication. That song he's playing is this. That's right, yacht rock superstars Toto. It's not necessarily that Tonji likes Toto. He may, I don't know. Toto just has good beats and good rhythms. Tonji's very practical in this sense. And he's very practical when I asked him what his dream job would be.
Anywhere from Faith Hill to Steely Dan. I'm just kidding. Faith Hill would be probably the best gig. A lot of money and you get to see good-looking ladies every night, so you can't complain. However, there is that hairy weasel of hers that...
What's his name? Tim...
Tim, the cowboy hat.
Aside from his love of pop music, old and new, Tonji can wax rhapsodic about the different rhythmic structures of Croatian versus Serbian music. He can differentiate and play time signatures that I couldn't even begin to count. He's a really cool guy. I see him every now and then drumming away in the parking lot, and it makes me glad he lives in my neighborhood. And it makes me glad that I talk to strangers. For Smart City Radio, I'm Scotty Isare.
This week, City View's commentator Walker Smith has the election season on his mind. He's got advice for politicians on how they can change their rhetoric to talk to people about what matters most.
Social critic and columnist David Brooks wrote recently in the New York Times that the conservative movement in Britain is enjoying a revival driven by a new emphasis that is focused less on economics and more on quality of life. It is about social issues, not economic issues. It turns on the happiness of citizens, not the role of government. The result is a much stronger resonance with the concerns of today's voters. The implications of this are manifold. The focus of old was economic revival through free markets and less government. The focus of the future is said to be social revival. It's not about individual freedoms anymore. It's about the well-being of families, neighborhoods, and communities. Conservatives in Britain, writes Brooks, have begun to emphasize issues new to them, like environmentalism, civility, assimilation, social bonds, and organic networks. And they are putting a new quality of life spin on traditional issues like moral climate, families, children, and marriage. Much of this shift in focus is about connecting with the new agenda of voters, an agenda that is ascendant in this country as well. After decades of expanding prosperity, Americans have begun to look beyond material success and money as the only foundations of a satisfying quality of life. Connecting with others is chief among people's new priorities. So are balance, stress management, civility, and good health. Communities, not ideologies, are the new center of gravity in politics. Well-being, not party line, will soon be the new criterion of good policy among American voters. But politicians in the U.S. have yet to recognize this to the extent true of their British counterparts. The politics of polarization continue to hold sway here. The rhetoric of smear and attack still dominates political dialogue. Politicians focus on divisive issues rather than the unifying common concerns about quality of life. The politics of fear have yet to be supplanted by the politics of caring. But it is coming. Indeed, our next president will have two opportunities to rally our nation behind a great shared ambition, the way JFK inspired us to put a man on the moon. Neither of these is about a new space program. Instead, they are directly connected to our quality of life. One is to challenge us to break the stranglehold of oil on our nation with all of the accompanying quality of life improvements that would result from weaning ourselves away from this increasingly scarce resource. The other is to rouse us to become better stewards of our national good fortune. We overconsume just about everything, from food to energy to TV. There's nothing wrong with any of it, except in excess, because then it erodes our quality of life. We have lost some of the discipline and maturity that once made us the moral beacon of the world. Our quality of life is no longer the first among nations. For our own sakes, as much as for the sake of others, it is time to put it in the forefront again. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. His latest book is Generation Ageless. We'd like to welcome our new listeners on WFSU in Florida. If you're a listener who catches the show via our podcast and want to hear Smart City on the air on your local station, contact us at questions@smartcityradio.com. Or you can contact us through our website. Just head over to smartcityradio.com and click the contact button. While you're there, you can listen to archive shows, sign up for our weekly newsletter, or subscribe to our podcast. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer, engineer, and resident rock critic. I'm Carol Coletta.